This mortal coil.
Well, tonight, you're getting a lesson in a religion that's said to be the oldest monotheistic religion in the world, that is, worshipping one god, dating back to at least the 5th century BC with its roots in ancient Persia. Its three tenets are good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. Despite its long history, many of you may have never heard of Zoroastrianism. And with estimates suggesting there are now less than 200,000 Zoroastrians worldwide, it will be interesting to learn about this very old religion and have a look at what its future looks like. Dun Karai and Simone Carset are both members of the Australian Zoroastrian Association. They've come into the studio this evening to shed some light on their faith. Hello, welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
Well, now, Dun, I'm going to start with you because I'm told you're the person who can tell us all about the history. Tell us about the prophet that founded Zoroastrianism.
So Zarathustra is supposed to have been born around 1500 BC, providing an unbroken continuum to this day of our religion, Zoroastrianism. It's centered around the Caspian Sea, the eastern Iranian plateau, around the Russian steppes. And it's a very simple religion. It basically tells us how to live. It provides direction for life. It was a state religion for many years since Zarathustra's time to 7th century AD and the advent of Islam into Persia.
All right, so tell us a bit more about, as I said, I've read about this, I guess, god, Ahura Mazda. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but tell us about Ahura Mazda and what I guess, your concept of him.
So
I don't know if it's a him or a her,
we
actually.
We have three key beliefs. One is, of course, as you mentioned, it's the oldest monotheistic religion, which is it only believes in one god. We call him Ahura Mazda, which is a god of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And it basically is about sharing with the world that Zoroastrians must strive to live a life of wisdom. It's also provided and filtered into the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, with the fact that it was a proponent of monotheism, mm-hmm. but it also talked about separate forces of good versus evil, that they are actually evil is an independent and potent force of its own. And the third thing it brought into was about after death and the concept of heaven and hell. Heaven if you're rewarded, and hell as retribution.
So that was a Zoroastrian concept,
yes,
before it was a Christian concept.
Absolutely. Unlike the Indo religion, the Hindu religion, which was around many gods, around good and evil can come from the same god, and about the cycle of death and life and rebirth, which Zoroastrianism doesn't believe in.
And so it was the state religion in what we would think of as what, ancient Persia?
Yeah. Oh, and Persian Empire was really very big up to Greece, up to north, up to the Russian steppes and what is now Russia, in the west up to China and India, and down south up to the northern Africa. And so it was very, very big religion, but people know it like because of some of the great empires and King Cyrus the Great, who gave the first Bill of Rights and human rights in the world. You can read it in the cylinder in the British Museum and in the United Nations lobby. And he's the one, when he conquered Babylon, as per the cylinder, he freed the Jews and made them return, allowed them to return to Jerusalem with their religious artifacts to build the Temple of Jerusalem again. Then, of course, Darius and Xerxes, which are also very famous.
Mm. So I said, having read Herodotus, all of these names popped up in there. It's so exotic, I find, to think of these ancient empires and this religion, which is so old. Now, in the 7th century AD, that's when the Islamic religion really began sweeping across the whole region. What did that mean for Zoroastrianism, Dun?
Well, what happened is that when Islam started conquering the lands, which was a stronghold of Zoroastrians and Zoroastrianism, a group fled by boat to India and took refuge in a place in Gujarat called Sanjan. And there we made promise to the king in terms of the five conditions that he put on us. And mainly it is about understanding our religion, wearing the dress of the land, mm-hmm. using the language of the land, and not having any weapons and marrying only after sunset. But I guess the most important thing, and it's a well-known anecdote, that because of the clash of language and being able to express themselves, the Zoroastrian priest who had landed with a few Zoroastrians from Iran asked for a bowl of milk and sugar. And he said that just as the sugar has assimilated and enriched the milk and made it sweeter, we will assimilate and make your country, your area, your kingdom richer.
And since then, did Zoroastrians spread out right across India?
Yeah, actually it did. And the British used us because we were very, very forward and modernized always in our thought and mm-hmm. thinking. And we had literacy from the 1600s when Zoroastrians opened schools for our people. They actually used us a lot for trade with China and to be able to go and start the commercial center of Bombay. Mm. So we spread across, but mainly centered then in Gujarat and Bombay.
Mm. Does Zoroastrianism have, I mean, I'm not sure if this is a question for you, Simone, but does it have a book written down, you know, a history and rules?
Oh, yes. Well, there is the Avesta, which mm-hmm. is our holy book, and also the Gathas, which is a series of prayers as well. And every day we say our prayers. So we tie a kasti around our waist, which is like a rope around our waist. And during that time, we say a set of kasti prayers every day, and sometimes more than once a day, sometimes twice a day.
Mm. Tell me then, Dan, you grew up in Mumbai. So tell us a little bit about your background, because you would have seen the Zoroastrian community in Mumbai and can tell us a bit about what it's like there.
So if one goes to Mumbai, you'll see there are statues, marble statues of Zoroastrians everywhere, because Zoroastrians really, it was Sir Jamshedji Jiji Boy, one of the princely merchants who actually built the infrastructure to make seven islands into one and helped the East India Company with its trade, along with other princely merchants like the Wadias and the Tatas and the Ready Moneys, etc. And because they quickly adapted the language of English and had the schools, they could actually help the British in ruling and opening the law courts and to really help in commerce. So they've actually helped build a lot of the commercial centres, the main one being Bombay.
So are Zoroastrians often then well-regarded, influential members of the community in India?
And I think that also comes to some of our basic tenets, that we are very philanthropic and we really put charity in the forefront of our lives. Our one basic tenet is to live a life of righteousness. And the highest form of righteousness is actually truth. And our religion tells us, and we have a Lord's Prayer in which we pray often, and that is all about telling us to live a life of righteousness and truth. And then we have free thinking, where they say, listen with your ears to the best thoughts, the best words, but then you have to reflect and think for yourself and make your decisions. And you have choices, one of good and one of evil. So all this sort of helped to be able to live a life that was rich and enriching of people and communities around us.
Mm. I mean, India hasn't been short of its religious differences over the years, particularly between the Hindus and the Muslims. Did the Zoroastrians manage to escape from some of that division?
I think we were too small a population mm-hmm. and we were so focused on commerce and literacy and improving the prosperity. And we just wouldn't have been able to compete or compare with those two big, vast religions. And I think a lot of us, or a lot of the Zoroastrians just sort of kept to themselves from these racial strife.
We are talking to Dun Karai and Simone Carsett, who are both members of the Australian Zoroastrian Association. We're learning a little bit about this this very old religion in This Mortal Coil on Nightlife on this Sunday night. Now, Simone, you're a teacher and coordinator of the Zoroastrian Sunday School in Sydney. If a young child was asked, you know, what is Zoroastrianism, how would you teach them to respond to that?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that, you know, when you said it's one of the oldest religions in the world and the belief of one God, and I think that's, and the whole idea of humata hukata huvarshta, which is say, you know, think good thoughts, say good words and do good deeds, as being, you know, our belief, our motto, our tenet of how we live. And that's how I think a lot of the children sort of explain and also say it's one of the oldest religions in the world, you know.
So what does practicing Zoroastrianism look like? Is there the equivalent of a church or a mosque?
That's a really good question. Yeah, so basically, yeah, we do have different types of temples. One of the highest is the Behram Yezid Temple. So that we have, and then we have Agyaris as well, and then we have Daba Meir, which is what we have here in New South Wales. It's like a small hall in which we hold one of our fires, which we put on, you know, when we are there. Otherwise, the one that's in India and Iran, in one of the highest temples, that is continuously running throughout. It's a never-ending fire.
Now, fire is really important, isn't it?
Yes, like we pray in front of the fire. So that's like, you know, it's not, you know, they always say, oh, our Zoroastrians, fire worshippers, we're not fire worshippers, but we believe in the importance of light, you know, light being one of the seven creations, the sun.
Mm. Now, you do Sunday school, so again, much like Christianity, is that, I mean, is the same idea about the creation of the world very similar to the Christian idea about that?
The Christians believe that it was created in 7 days. Mm-hmm. So ours is more on the focus of the seven creations as well. Not saying that it was created in 7 days, but just saying that, you know, that the importance of each element and, you know, about protecting this world and the environment that we live in. And that's a huge focus that we have in teaching in Sunday school, because we have quite a big, you know, set of grounds over there. And, you know, we believe in maintaining the earth and also, you know, enriching the earth.
Mm. And you were telling me before, people come from far and wide to go to Sunday school, don't they?
That's true, yeah. So people sometimes travel hours to come to Sunday school because it's so important that they want to meet, you know, members of the community. They want to meet their friends, and they do travel sometimes 1 hour, 2 hours, and sometimes from Wollongong and, you know, interstate as well, just to come to the AZA and, you know, come to Sunday school to have their children interact with one another. Because, you know, so many kids, they go to school with you know, the general in public type area. So that to be with the member of their own community, it's, you know, really wonderful.
Oh, because you don't all sort of live in, for example, one part of Sydney. So it's, you really have to make that effort to get together.
Absolutely. That's, you know, and that's the commitment of the family, the parents, that they make to bring their children to Sunday school.
Mm. Now, I'm interested in the afterlife and the concept of this, because the burial practices in Zoroastrianism, well, they're not actually burial practices, are they? Dun, can you tell us about what happens when someone dies who is a Zoroastrian?
So the religious concept is that when someone dies, it's because evil have attacked their bodies and the body becomes impure, and what one dies. And we have ceremonies, the death ceremonies around it. But yes, everyone asks the question because they all know about the Towers of Silence in Persia and in Central Asia and even in India, where the Zoroastrians created the Towers of Silence in Bombay. And yes, we put our dead bodies into a well, and the vultures, if they're there, can pick at them, pick the flesh, and then the bones are left to dry in the sun or through solar panels, which is more what they put now, because the vultures are not as many or very, very few left, if any. So that's really what happens. But I guess the most important thing is what happens in the afterlife, which is that based on the actions you have done in your life, you then are actually rewarded and have heaven, or there's retribution in terms of hell. But everyone is promised redemption at the end. And that was one of the big differences with the proto-Indo religion, which was about the cycle of birth and rebirth. Zoroastrianism and Zoroastra put in the concept of heaven and hell.
Someone's just asking, Barry says, I'm curious, do you have any rulings against alcohol in your religion?
Nothing.
Definitely not.
In fact, it's a religion of total moderation. We do not deny ourselves. We do not believe in fasting or denying ourselves anything. It's a religion of fun, of happiness, of warmth, of love, and everything in moderation. Everything in moderation is a life well lived in Zoroastrianism.
All right. So there's none of those very strict rules about how to behave, except I guess those three tenets you really talked about, the good deeds, the good thoughts and
good words.
And the good words.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking about Zoroastrianism and this mortal coil on Nightlife tonight. My guests are Dan Carey and Simone Cassad, who are both from the Australian Zoroastrian Association. Simone, how many Zoroastrians live in Australia?
Yeah, well, the numbers have grown exponentially. I mean, you know, they say that it's about 5,000 at the moment, you know, that are in Australia, and with the really growing number in New South Wales and in Sydney in particular.
But that's grown. You've noticed a real increase?
Absolutely. At Sunday school, I mean, you know, there used to be maybe 20 students. Now there's 55 students, and so many of them are, you know, of the smaller age group. That means they're newly born Zoroastrians entering into our community, you know, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds.
And Simone, I understand that would be due to immigration, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely immigration, and also marriage, like, you know, within the community. So my friends, like so many of them, have toddlers now, which I just love. I love to see that, you know, the people that I've grown up with are now having 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds. It's beautiful to see.
Now, I said that the increase in numbers would be due to immigration, because the issue of conversion is, well, those rules at least are a bit hard and fast, aren't they? Can you explain, Simone, if I wanted to study and convert to Zoroastrianism, could I?
Well, we don't have conversion in our religion, because it's passed down through a bloodline, essentially, like Judaism passes through female bloodline, ours is through the paternal bloodline. And, you know, I think it's also partly, it's more than a religion, it's a culture as well, you know, and like when you see a Zoroastrian, you know, you can see distinguishing features, you know, the food that we eat, how we speak, you know, it's a whole combination of things, not just the religion itself.
Also, how do people look different then, if you're a Zoroastrian? How do you tell one, Dan? Or should we put that back to Simone, given she said that?
That's on the spot. But
how you can tell someone is Zoroastrian is sometimes there are some things, which is one that I mentioned earlier, was a sadar and kasti. Like, you don't see it, but they wear it underneath. It's an undergarment. So when I was younger and, you know, we would go to swimming class in school, I would be wearing this undergarment, which is a sort of like a cotton singlet underneath, and a rope which is made of lamb's wool around my waist. So, you know, that is a distinguishing feature of what they even, you know, used to look at in Iran to distinguish who was a Zoroastrian during that, you know, great wartime as well. And of course, the fravashi, which is one of our symbols, you know, of not only it's an Iranian symbol, but it's also used in Zoroastrian faith. So it's almost like a winged disc with a man sitting on top. So I can show you one. I'm wearing one now just for you to see. So basically, this is a symbol of like a guardian angel. So just like how Christians wear crosses, this is also something that might distinguish.
So if you saw someone wearing
they
one of
might
those,
be Zoroastrian or of Iran or of Iranian descent.
Yeah. Yeah. And Dan, what about the food? What foods are particular to Zoroastrians?
I think a lot of Persian foods, I mean, Zoroastrians, it depends whether you live in Persia or whether you live really in India. Mm-hmm. Because in India, we took on a lot of the Indian foods and the spices, but also a lot of British and French influence came into our foods. Whether we had Irish stew growing up or baked dishes or poached a fish, a blancmange, it didn't matter, but a lot of Zoroastrians and Parsis would have that as normal foods. And a lot of the Persian influence is what came into India from the Mughals, because the Mughals came from Persia to rule India for over 1,000 years. So a lot of the kebabs and the naans and the beautiful fragrant saffron rice. So that there are Persian restaurants here that you can go and eat Persian food, mm-hmm. which would give you a taste of how Zoroastrians, especially in Persia and India, would eat.
Mm. Simone, do you have any particular festivals that you celebrate?
Yes, we do. So I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Nowruz. So Nowruz is there's Nowruz in the Iranian culture, and also the Parsis also have their Nowruz festivals. So Nowruz essentially literally means new day. Mm-hmm. So it's the celebration of the spring equinox. So it's welcoming in spring. And there's two different Nowruz dates. So there's one that's celebrated globally in March. And then there's one that the Parsi celebrate, which is the Indian Zoroastrians. And that's in August. And the reason, the difference between the two is because the Parsi Zoroastrians follow a different calendar that doesn't have leap years in it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's no leap years, so it ends up being 200 days mm-hmm. in or days in difference often. So that's why we have two birthdays as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Simone, let's just go back to this question about conversion, because I said the numbers of Zoroastrians around the world are down to, I think, under 200,000. Mm-hmm. It is an issue that comes up within the community, isn't it?
Oh, it's always a topic of debate. Like, I've been to a number of international congresses around in US, in India, and this is always a topic of debate. But, like, I think what it always comes down to is that though people say we're, like, decreasing in numbers, we've still thrived throughout all these years, through thousands of years, we've thrived. And, you know, I think we're going to continue to thrive as a community. We're growing, in fact. So, like, I wouldn't say that it would ever die out.
That does rely, doesn't it, though, on all the young Zoroastrians being willing to marry another young Zoroastrian.
That's true. And, like, and I mean, that's absolutely right, because even myself, I mean, I, you know, being a young Zoroastrian growing up in Australia, you know, you hope to marry someone of the same religion. And I was lucky enough to find someone from the same religion.
Now, I understand you've got a great story about meeting your husband. You better tell us this.
What happened was my brother and sister-in-law, they were matchmade through a matchmaker in India. So I went to the wedding over there in India, and the matchmaker was there. And she said, "Simone, are you married yet?" And I said, "No, not yet." So she's like, "Okay, I'm going to find you a wonderful boy." So she went out and she obviously had my name and all my details. And she sent me 80 boys' names from across the world and said, "You can call any of these or contact these boys." And, you know, and I said, "I'm not going to contact anyone. Like, you know, I'm not the type of person to just contact someone over the internet." But she gave my name to my husband's mother, and his mum said, "You have to contact this girl. She's from Sydney. You know, there's something about her." And then it took him a while, but finally on a April Fool's Day, one fine April, he just wrote to me on Facebook and said, "Hi." That was it. And then I said, "Oh, hi, how are you?" And he was in New Zealand at the time. And we just started talking for 15 hours straight.
Wow.
What?
And oh my goodness.
In that 15 yeah. hours, he says to me, I think I'm going to marry you. In the first 15 hours of talking, the next day we spoke for 10 hours, the next day we spoke and we didn't stop talking until he came to meet me like 2 months later. And he then proposed in front of my mom and dad right then and there. And
he's sitting out in the foyer here tonight.
And he's sitting out here. Yes, Jimmy's out there in the foyer. And I couldn't be more happier. I feel like the luckiest girl in the world. And it was just meant to be. That was the type of, you know, it was a wonderful feeling.
And Dan, I think you've got two sons. Is there a lot of pressure on young Zoroastrians to find each other and have children? What if one of your sons had come to you and said, you know, I've fallen in love with someone who's not a Zoroastrian?
Yeah, so I'm lucky that my eldest son, Xerxes, married one of the girls he knew in Sunday school for a year. And they're very happy.
This is why the Sunday school's important, right? It's, yeah. it's a matchmaking service.
Sure is.
And they have Zara, who's now about 8 months old. And my other son, Cyrus, he's studying in the United States. I think it would have upset me a little because, but you know, you can't hold it against it when you're in different countries. But I had gone to study in the United States and came back to sort of listen to my parents. And I was lucky that I met and fell in love with my husband at a party. But my sisters had arranged marriage. They're very, very happy. So it's a life of moderation. But yes, we're just lucky. What I say that my son married Zoroastrian, we've just been lucky.
But is that something that is taught to your children from an early age,
yeah,
that expectation that you should?
Well, it's the only thing I asked my sons in return.
Said, do whatever you like, but marry a Zoroastrian.
You could marry a Zoroastrian because it's such a wonderfully calming and, you know, environmentally friendly and easy religion. Why wouldn't you want to, you know, and focus on education and commerce and doing charity and philanthropy and looking after your community? You know, all religions are good, but you're born in Zoroastrianism, so perhaps you have to give it a special focus.
Mm. So, Dom, what happens when someone marries outside of the faith? Are they shunned in any way?
Well, they used to be, I suppose, in my generation, which was very, very rare. But I guess in my children's generation, it is very common. And we just have to make the best of it. It's very hard because also, I guess in my generation, we were more open to listen to our parents. And we stayed in Mumbai in a community which was really, you knew a lot of Zoroastrians. It's not the same overseas. And even in India, they're intermarrying a lot. So as I said, I keep thinking it's got to be luck.
And the services, in Simone's case, an excellent matchmaker and a very keen New Zealander. Yes. Simone, there are initiation ceremonies, aren't they, for children becoming Zoroastrians?
Oh, yes. Yes. So that's called a Navjot ceremony in India. And then the Kasti and the Pushi ceremony as well in Iranians. So, like, basically it's initiation into the religion. Now, we do have some Navjot ceremonies held here in Australia, you know, with the help of our Dastarjis, our priests as well. So I've been to a number of wonderful Navjot ceremonies where they're given their first sadra and kasti. So what I talked about, the undergarments that we wear, that's the time when they're given their first sadra and kasti, and they say a set of prayers as well, their first kasti prayers.
Mm. And that garment, how important is it to wear that?
Oh, it's. I think it's very important. I've worn it every day of my life. So not all Zoroastrians wear it every day. They sometimes wear it when they say their prayers. But it's almost like a shield from evil. It also carries your good deeds with you. So like a part of that is, you know, it's inbuilt. It's and when you say your prayers, you know, you feel that connection to our Mazda.
And is it worn by men as well as women?
Yes, both men and women wear. I'm wearing one right now.
Okay. And so what happens, for example, Christmas? Is that something that you would mark or ignore?
Oh, Yeah, I definitely. Even, you know, in Sunday school, we do have a Christmas party, you know. I mean, it's a part of our culture, like as in to celebrate others. We always respect every religion. That's one of the things that we always do. We never say anyone is wrong or what you do is right and what we do is wrong. We respect every single religion.
Mm. Just one final question to you, Dan. Are there any ancient monuments to Ahura Mazda? You know, if you go to Persia or Iran today, do you see any kind of archaeological temples or anything like that?
Yes, actually, there are rock sculptures in southwest Iran, which actually has the figurine that we take it as Zarathustra.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of rock carvings of that. So that's from where we have got. Usually it was mostly done during the time of Darius, the son of Cyrus the Great. And so we do have an image of Zarathustra, and it is very common, and you do see it in lots of places. That and, as Simon said, the Fravashi, which a lot of us wear, and which is the...
It's that one you've got on too?
Yeah.
It's the guard. It's your personal protector, your guardian angel, your personal sort of to keep with you, to protect you. If you go to Iran and Persia, you will see that.
Everywhere.
I mean, you go to the Louvre, you go to the British Museum, you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, you'll see the Persian galleries, and you will see the Fravashi, the winged icons over there.
Because remembering, as we say, when Islam came in the 7th century, it sort of pushed it out, but it was so dominant until then. It was, in fact, the religion of ancient Persia.
I mean, it's right till 7th century AD. It was a state religion and national religion, and now there are still Zoroastrians, and so it's not really died or collapsed or whatever. And Persia was one of the biggest empires in the Western world. So,
Well, thank you both for coming in and telling us about Zoroastrianism tonight. It's been really fascinating to learn a bit about it, because I really didn't know much apart from the vultures and the Towers of Silence, of course, and a bit about its age. But it's really interesting to learn about a different religion, and I wish you luck in the future for all of your children finding husbands and wives who can help you continue on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Susan.
So that's John Karai and Simone Kasset, who are both from the Australian Zoroastrian Association.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.